Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Naughton. I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a continuation of our ongoing series, Conversations with Remarkable Minds, a philosophical and psychological exploration into the origins of our society's dysfunction and the emergence of a new culture. Professor Ashok Gangadean, G-A-N-G-A-D-E-A-N. He is a distinguished Margaret Guest Professor of Global Philosophy at Haverford College in Pennsylvania, where he has taught for more than 40 years. His lifelong study and passion has been to clarify the common ground at the heart of human reason and to promote a deeper dialogue to bring forth a more integral and holistic global consciousness, which can remedy the apocalyptic fervor associated with our fragmented world. He is the founder of the Global Dialogue Institute, a co-founder of the World Commission on Global Consciousness and Spirituality, which, by the way, includes Irvin Laszlo, Desmond Tutu, Hazel Henderson, Jane Goodall, Robert Thurman, Cornel West. And he is the host of the award-winning program Global Lens on PBS in Philadelphia. We will be talking in depth on this very important topic. The topic today is a philosophical and psychological exploration into the origins and our society's dysfunction and the emergence of a new culture. Nice to have you with us today.
Pleasure to visit with you again.
Also, his newest books are Meditative Reason, Towards a Universal Grammar, as well as Between Worlds, The Emergence of Global Reason. As you know, on this program, we always take our time. We rush nothing. You'll have all the opportunity you want to explore any of the issues in depth, use examples wherever possible. We have a worldwide audience. And since the last time you were on the program several years ago, we have been witnessing greater division between various political, social, racial, and economic factions in the United States. Now, aside from the gridlock that has overtaken the federal political body, we're also witnessing that if issues cannot be decided and implemented democratically, then they can be implemented through deception and corruption. The government's National Security Agency program, for example, from that we are learning they've been spying on the entire population and gathering personal data far beyond Congress and what any of the agencies of government needed or even ask for. In fact, the latest revelations are that they were very specifically looking into all of the online porno so that they could build a profile about what a person's fetishes were, what they wanted. And I have to ask, why would they need this? No one knew that every single phone call, every single meeting, every single email has been recorded and captured, not simply the date or time or who the message was, but the actual messages. And our current leader continues to be disingenuous, suggesting that they don't have the actual message. They have everything, every word, every syllable that anyone has ever shared, every photograph, every anything electronic. Then there has been a reemergence of a fanatical right, fundamentalistic religion, racism, and a militarized of state and local law enforcement. Even in medicine and healthcare, we're witnessing a kind of totalitarian agenda. For example, mandatory healthcare through the private insurance industry. The law for Obamacare was written by the insurance industry, their lobbyist. They then got with Backus and other Democrats, and that is how this came into being. None of this was created by those in the field who knew what we need to get healthier, stay healthier, to prevent disease, and understand the relationship between stress and disease, the environment and disease. None of that is included. In fact, based upon the earlier research I did, where medicine is the number one cause of death and injury, this will mean millions of more Americans will die, and hundreds of millions of Americans over the next decade will become injured because of it. Then we have corporations writing our bills. ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has in secret for over 30 years been meeting on a regular basis with our state representatives and exclusive resorts, coaching them on bills that the legislators take back and then enact as laws. Until a year ago, no one knew that ALEC even existed, except for the hundreds of corporations that are part of it. So what does it tell us when our elected officials are not representing the wishes and needs of the population? So when we gather all these regressive efforts and policies together into a whole, we could witness an agenda, a paradigm, that is a large departure from those higher values of democracy and liberty and freedom of expression and belief and economic and environmental sustainability and honoring and respecting the individual regardless of social class, status, or ethnicity. So take your time. How should we make sense of this widespread rise of regressive thought and action that is so contrary to principles that are universal when it comes to ethics?
Wow, that's a wonderful laying out, Gary, of the highlights of a kind of cultural, social, political dysfunction embedded deeply in our culture. And so just breathe. I love the way that you set the tone. So let's breathe and take our time and try to step back and get to the deeper source of the origins of the societal dysfunctions. Where does it come from? What's driving it? What's at the heart of it? And my journey as a philosopher for the last 50 years, looking at the wisdom, you speak of the democratic values and the principles that we allege and the disconnect with the regressive practices and malpractices. And this is the Progressive Radio Network, thank goodness, for this space to reflect. And so looking at the wisdom across the planet, that I mean looking at Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and the founding of the European consciousness about Plato's Republic and wisdom has to rule in the society, those themes. And Socrates, you've got to leave a cave of ignorance and come into the light of reason, unfolding over 2,500 years, that image, or the Vedantic philosophy of Om and the yoga, looking at the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna breaks down in a polarized, dysfunctional family war, and he sees that the ethics and the culture is failing, and he breaks down, and Krishna, the voice of wisdom, the higher voice of Om, starts to give him therapy and progressive advice, so to speak, evolutionary awakening of the yoga science and medicine to come into wholeness and break out of the polar and fragmenting ways that Arjuna didn't understand, or Buddha's awakening. He saw that existence is suffering, and the medicine, it brought medicine to the culture, cultural medicine to heal our broken lives and being, our dysfunction. If we have ill-being, we can't flourish. We need well-being, and Buddha prescribed and diagnosed deeply into the origins of the society dysfunctions and malpractice. Lao Tzu in the Chinese origins, the Tao that is named is not the Tao. Yahweh, Abraham, calling out, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one. Love me with all you got. Jesus, you know, calling us to a higher script out of the broken sin consciousness that afflicted humanity. So east it's samsara, west it's sin, and across the board, all the way through centuries of labor to help bring to humanity the medicine, we've got to upscript from our state of consciousness where we've evolved to this adolescent phase of talking about it and objectifying our information, which is a great gift and a great miracle in evolution, but we got stuck there in some kind of level of consciousness that all of our great geniuses and scriptures saw. Folks, you got to rise out of that dysfunction. Why? Because that level of thinking and objectifying and putting information in the box and atomizing each piece of information is going to fragment our minds, polarize everything in our lives, all of our experience, polarize us as humans, and we're born to be integral, holistic beings, but it's going to divide our mind and our body, it's going to divide me and you, it's going to polarize our perspectives, it's going to degenerate into radically competing worldviews and competing narratives about what is first. And when you put those together in a global shared space and a common ground, they break and they fragment and they lead to precisely the kind of indigenous inherent dysfunction that you see on all sides. There's something driving all of this. And so just to start our conversation and reflection on what is this, and do our great geniuses and scriptures, which we honor so highly, and what did Jesus, his breakthrough into the Christ consciousness that took centuries to lead to the Quaker clarification, and I teach at Haverford, founded by the Quakers. So coming through George Fox and to William Penn and the Philadelphia founding of America, and to Rufus Jones, the mystic at Haverford, who founded the philosophy on the Quaker principles. And I teach in Founders Hall. And what is Founders Hall? The place in which we find the integral union and that of Christ in every human. For example, I'm just giving examples. So when you look at the weight, the predominant weight of wisdom and scripture, all calling humanity to step into an integral I-thou form of life and leave the I-it, where we objectify and polarize and fragment, and we're not aware that our script encodes the kind of sin scripts, the separation from the field, from the zone, so to speak. And so the collective wisdom that Plato said we need wisdom and culture for democracy to work, for we to be we the people, rather than a fragmentation of power plays and corporations pressing for their own perspectives and bills, and medicine not getting a proper hearing for genuine understanding what it takes to heal a whole human being in the integral medical space across borders beyond allopathic medicine, which, as you pointed out, it's alarming that medicine as such in that ego-mental space and ego-mental science is a source of death. That's an alarming thing to see and say. And the inherent gridlock and fragmentation in the political space where it's supposed to be we the people. It's on academic campuses, too. Our liberal arts are fragmented and divided into specialized fields, and we're gasping to get interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary awareness, but we're trapped in the fragmented box. So this is just for starters, Gary, that the wisdom of the planet, the Enlightenment teachers, diagnose the medical condition, that society that's blocked and locked into ego-mental and monocentric patterns where we look through our lens and we're not aware of it, and we don't know how to communicate and find dialogue across our diverse worldviews and perspectives. That takes skills and literacy, and we just haven't cultivated that enough. So I just to share that with you, and let's just jazz together.
Great. Does it ever surprise you that the most important positions in a society, a council of elders, we never have people who are coming from a spiritual perspective, but always from political and then from their ideological, financial implementations?
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, that's part of the symptom itself. Because if, just to use a kind of a vision, I usually, when I'm lecturing around the world, I use a sketch pad, so to speak, to put some calligraphy and help people visualize two different language spaces. And I use single strokes to mark when we're in the ego-mental space of the I-it, where everything is an it, a piece of a mind bite. We treat ourselves in that space on that screen of ego awareness. And we have our worldviews, our experience, our lives, our mental states, our inner and outer perceptions all show up on that screen. I use single strokes to mark when we're in that space. That was never done before. And our great teachers really were seeing that space as deeply problematic and holding humanity back. And when we cross into the zone, into the unified field, whether you call it Tao, Yahweh, Allah, Om, Brahman, Atman, Christ, God, whatever name you use for the field, the infinite field must be infinitely one. They all knew that. You can't have more multiple infinites. So the primal first field is one and unifying, and it holds the sources and holds everything together. And I discovered as a philosopher and logician over years that our diverse geniuses were tapping that field, and there's a grammar, a code. And I use double parentheses to mark when Jesus is speaking, or Krishna is speaking, or Buddha is speaking, or Socrates is seeking to get us out of the cave, on and on. So you have single markers, single strokes, that's called, for the ego-mental culture and life and space, which is not going to have wisdom rule, and the double parentheses space, the infinite zone, let's call it. When you're in the zone, then you have an integral calculus and a healing space, and we become human. That's I-thou. So there's the I-it and the I-thou. And your question, put in this space, if wisdom is the I-thou moral space where we discover our sacred self in the other and in the environment, I mean, we want to live by that honor code, that is not going to preside in the highest offices in a single bracket monocentric culture. it's just not going to happen because it's allergic to the double bracket. It's phobic about it. It puts them to death. Socrates got hemlock. Jesus got the cross. Gandhi gets taken out one after the other. It's allergic. So how are you going to have wisdom in the civic space and in the civic culture when it's dominated by monocentric, single bracket, ego-mental thinking? That's the great challenge we face on the planet.
H. Hoke, let's divide this issue into two parts, if you would, please. It was George Bernard Shaw, the great British essayist and playwright and writer, who said, "We have no more right to consume happiness without producing it than to consume wealth without producing it." In a society where our focus is almost an obsession to distract ourselves from what we cannot handle, don't want to face, so that we can find something that represents meaningfulness and hence our sense of happiness. And yet I believe that we are not finding happiness. We're a very unhappy group as a society. Many individuals are, but not as a society, because we're focused upon the things that are supposed to give us happiness. And then the other side of that is almost always when you have people who don't have happiness, who don't feel complete, who are not resonating that lightness of spirit, which now the physicists say we are light beings. There's actually a light force within it, in every cell. And as we bring in the light of healing plants, a clean diet, a positive people, love, that causes the vibration of every cell in our body to resonate this light. And when we die or we get sick or when we're in crisis, when we're angry, when we're stressed, that energy diminishes. And that's why we feel fatigue, and that's why we don't have that lightness. And the other side of that is what Hermann Hesse said, and that is, if you hate a person, you hate something in him that is a part of yourself. What isn't part of ourselves doesn't disturb us. Now think of how many people in society today, everything they do is based upon projecting negative energy towards some class, some group, some body politics, some ideologues. It is an obsession. Could you address these two issues, please?
Well, but again, you ask beautiful, deep questions, and thinking of Shaw and the idea of well-being and flourishing and the light beings and the vibration that you see in the I-Thou space. But I just assume that our listeners are with us now, that when we speak of the wisdom and enlightenment and scriptures of all our great geniuses, they're speaking out of this double parenthesis integral field of where everything is flowing and interflowing with each other, and that's where moral consciousness and science and aesthetics and beauty and love, when you say God is love, for example, it means that field is harmony and well-being. They knew that the medical prescription for individual and collective flourishing is to have the competence and literacy and script and intelligence to surf and get centered in that field. That's the Buddha field. That's the Christ field. That's the awakened space of logos for Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, for example, when Descartes said, "I am." And so he could doubt everything in the box, and he got scared. He said, so, and he hit the "I am." He tapped that deeper field, and he didn't have the culture to back him up to understand he had crossed into the zone, so to speak, of where we flourish. And that's where he discovered the I-Thou. The infinite other of God was present, and that was the light of reason. Again, and he sought to open up the values and future of culture and science and research in that light of reason. And that led to the birthing of the "we hold these truths to be self-evident" coming out of the European Enlightenment. So all of that on the one hand echoes what you said about Shaw, and yet people, and this is an astounding medical diagnosis. If we get obsessed with the box, what's in the box, our mental states are all on the screen, objectified as an it, as an object. They knew it's going to be deep frustration, the breakdown of knowledge, because it's not grounded in the field. It's going to lead to nihilism and despair and angst. The midlife crisis is going to be all through life. When Arjuna broke down on the battlefield and started the beautiful dialogue in the Gita, Bhagavad Gita, his life broke down because he was stuck in the samsaric field of fragmentation, cut off from the zone of Om and Atman and the Self, for example. So when you look again at the astounding reservoir and endowment of our wisdom across the planet and the medical consensus there, you see that if you get obsessed within the ego mental culture and life and experience and self-making and dealing with others, you're going to get that projection of negative energy. You're going to have phobia across borders. You're going to have Holocaust and genocides, ethnic cleansing, breakdown of love. Single bracket relations are not genuine double bracket relations of love, the I-thou space. When you cross into the I-thou, you open yourself, you drop your defensive lens, and you open to deep dialogue. And dialogue means dialogos, through the logos, enter the logos. And the logos from the Greek means a fundamental field of reason and light and speech, the light you speak about, the vibrational light that pervades every cell. It comes out of the logos, out of the om, out of the tao, out of the Buddha Shunyata field. So that's the overwhelming science. So the diagnosis, Gary, is that when we obsess with all our good intentions on stuff, on objects in the box, on trying to get things to solve and address our broken selves, our divided self, and being cut off from the zone, it's bound to fail. It eclipses the light. That's what Socrates says being in the cave. And that's what Krishna said in the Gita, the key to happiness and flourishing, which is moksha, is to break the barrier, the hypnotic trance of culture, that the sin script and the samsaric script of fragmentation has us captive and has colonized the people. And we're living in that kind of alienated colonial mental state where our script of objectification and materialization, that's the deep source, according to our geniuses, of our human dysfunction, individual and cultural, that leads to this projection and phobia and breakdown of relationships and moral consciousness and flow. And Hermann Hesse, on the other hand, another one of my great authors and creative geniuses that I admire, when he wrote Siddhartha, the novel, for example, and speaking about hating the other, Hesse understood that in the Buddha, in the Siddhartha novel, for example, when you try to capture the journey of Buddha, in Buddha's awakening, when you enter the Buddha field, what do you find? That we're all interlaced in Indra's net. We're all interflowing, the I and the thou. And to tend to the others, to tend to myself, to tend to the environment is to honor yourself, because it's all sacred space. This is the overwhelming consensus. When Jesus was in that Christ voice and said, when I was in prison, you visited me, and when I was hungry, you fed me. And the disciples in the single bracket monocentric mind, where it's across the planet, said, when did we do this? You know, unless you die, you cannot be born again, unless you let go of that obsession and fixation and addiction to the ego-mental single bracket technology, as great as it is to get us where we are, it's adolescent, and it's holding us back from maturing as full persons and full human beings. And so I think both your reference to Shaw and Hess really, again, echoes the theme we're bringing out, that wisdom and well-being brings us into the light. And if we surf the zone, when athletes are in the zone, and I use the zone metaphor as a user-friendly way to understand, we humans have access to the fields in our better moments and peak performance. And when we, as the jazz musicians, are zoning together, we are the music. When the runner has become the running, she is the running. That's zoning. When the basketball players and the team click together, nothing can stop it. The force is with us. That kind of thinking. We have access to the zone, and yet we're not there because we're caught in the box using a fragmenting calculus of the mind and culture, and which produces all kinds of human dysfunctions, alienation, fragmentation, and is driving the endemic cultural dysfunction that we see on all sides.
I want to do a thread off what you just said because it struck a chord with me. I want us to have a larger arch here for a moment, but go back to the 1970s. I was struck by something my mother told me early in life when I was too young to either understand it or to be able to use it. My mother was a sensitive in the South. That's a person that spends time with you and gives you some guidance by rebalancing energy, but never tells you what they see, nor presents a negative. It's always a positive. But she would always hold people's hands, and as a young kid, and they would come every night to our home, and I would watch in our small home, my mom, through the banisters as I was young, and she would counsel people, and I said, why do you hold their hands? And she said, because I'm trying to feel their energy. I said, what does that mean? She said, when a person is happy, when they're feeling love and appreciated, they vibrate a very positive energy. I'm trying to synchronize my energy with theirs. So in this moment, when they leave our house, they'll feel better than when they came in. And never fully appreciated till later when I was in New York, and I decided to put this to the test. So I put the word out to my radio audience, if you have any experience in healing, I'd like to have you in the lab. Now, I was a research scholar at the Institute of Applied Biology, mainly in anti-aging research, but I also did some psi research that was kept very quiet because it was a very orthodox place, mainly where they did chemotherapy research. And you couldn't begin to talk about anything that was not grounded in applied or basic sciences. Certainly you could not discuss anything about energy. They wouldn't understand. So the director told me, look, this work you're doing, go up on the third floor and do it, because no one ever goes up there. You know, it'll be your own space. And I did. So photographs of this are up on my website, and you'll see a woman sitting in a chair, and she's holding a mouse. That was mouse number 37. The woman was Dolores Krieger. She was head of the nursing department at New York University. From that experiment, therapeutic touch would be founded in the United States, which now is taught in every medical school in the United States, in every nursing school. And she had to have 6 out of 6 of her mice healed. And these mice only lived about 22 days. And of the 50 people applied, only 5 were able to do this healing. One of them, Dr. Audrey Carger, used light. And each of the others were known for having healing hands or healing energy. There was a chiropractor, there was a rabbi, Abraham Wiseman, a Dr. Thomas Kruth, the Order of St. Luke. But in any case, they all believed, but I couldn't prove, that it was from their beliefs that they took energy and transferred it into people, and in this case, little mice. And the reason I chose mice is because they couldn't be involved in a person's mumbo jumbo. You couldn't do a wink and a nod and get away with it. The mice either lived or they died, and then they had to live repeatedly. Now, at the end of this, I tried to get this published because this was very important. We could prove now that energy was transferred from people into mice repeatedly. Then with this, and I finally got it published in the Journal of Psychotronic Research, then I thought, okay, if we exchange energy, is the energy based upon innate wisdom or is it based upon knowledge? And I felt that knowledge is overblown. It's wisdom is undercredited. Knowledge or the accumulation of facts and disciplines is overemphasized, because this is something that would have to have existed out of all eternity. You can't have an isolated truth. If you have a universal truth, then it's universal. How you apply it is up to you. And to apply it again, I took a ficus bush, and it was a very healthy one, put it in a special lead-lined room. 10 people were each given a message. No one knew the message. They were all blinded. But when they got in the room, they opened up a piece of paper, and it might say, spray the plant. And the plant had an EEG machine hooked up to it. Another might say, sing to the plant. Another might say, massage gently the leaves. But 2 of them said, scream at the plant. And another one said, shake the plant and rip off 3 leaves. It was done. 3 months went by. Each one of those people walked back in the room. Nothing happened until the person that shouted and the person that tore the leaves off, and the needle just went crazy. The plant recognized the people. What did it recognize? It was an energy transfer. So then I started thinking, why can't people then eat the right food, energy food? Why can't they be around energy environments? Why can't they have energy friends? Why can't we synchronize at this higher level of consciousness? Now, that's the first part. That's why I said, when you mentioned something, it triggered that. But then I thought about, we lack imagination today on an individual level. It was Publius Syrus who said, the eyes are not responsible when the mind does not see. When the mind does the seeing, I should say. And then I thought about how we then imitate others without looking for the uniqueness of our own self. It was Eric Hoffer, someone who I know you're familiar with, who said, when people are free to do as they please, they usually imitate each other. And then I thought about all the people in our world, the educators, the leaders, including religious leaders today, where there is such indifference and such apathy to manifesting the uniqueness of each person working as sharing that energy to make it a better world. And there was Rollo May, who said, hate is not the opposite of love, apathy is. Could you address these, please?
Wow. Another amazing, beautifully articulated question, just to rehearse in terms of your mother and the hands and the healing hands and energy exchange and vibration of positive energy and some of your courageous attempt on the third floor to do vital research in energy, in the emergence of energy medicine and the truth of the transfer of energy. To me, I think this is validated profoundly when you look into the wider, beyond allopathic medicine that is dominated by a scientific lens that's in the box, in the objectifying, and we objectify the subject rather than the I-thou space. What would science and medicine be like in the I-thou space, where you open to the other, which is very actually deep science, is first science. When you enter the primal first field with the appropriate mental calculus and competence and rational capacity to open to the other and listen to the feedback, that's the energy space that our genius is all new and lived in. That's a human being. That's a mensch. When you're in the box, you're an ego sapien. You see, we were homo sapiens, which is a big con because the word sapiens means wisdom, the species of wisdom, homo sapien. But when we are stuck in the ego box and ego mentalism and monocentric minds and limited lenses, and we objectify our content, and we are dominated in our cultures and our lives by that, and our medicine, and our science, and our love life, all of it, and our eating, and our food habits, and our encounter with food, all of that's taking place in the objectified I-it. It's an it. It's an object. It's an entity. In contrast to the dilation of the energy of the heart, mind of the whole human, crossing into the dimension of wisdom, genuine wisdom, that's a logosapien, not an egosapien. You know, and the ego pillar has to mature as a Buddha fly, so to speak, just to play with that. And the journey of wisdom, as you beautifully point out, if we listen to wisdom rather than single bracket knowledge, facts in the box. Facts are in the box are artifacts of the lens that we use. If we have a Newton lens, we have a Newton box, a Newton facts, a Newton world. If you have an Einstein lens, you have an Einstein world. If you have a Hawking lens, you have a Hawking's world. If you can get to the grand unified field and open up the lens, you'll have a deeper physics and reality and medicine. So you nailed it beautifully when you said that the dominance of single bracket knowledge has eclipsed wisdom, which is primal knowing. The knowing in wisdom is intimate knowing of the knowing and the knower and the known, because you're not objectifying yourself or the other. You're standing in an open space. If you have a Van Gogh painting in the ego box, it's an object, you look at it, it's on the wall, you objectify it, it's an entity. And you too are an object because you're processed in that box. One it looking at another it. That's the nature of that kind of knowledge. If you dare to cross into the zone and open your heart and become vulnerable, as your mother demonstrated, in just touching the other person and touching the transfer of energy, that is not a paranormal experience, that's normal. That's normal energy flow in the zone. That's what it's all about. When you enter the yoga, what is that? The Om script, the Om zone. If you can handle that, the Gandhi space, what do you see? We're connected. Not that we're the same. There's diversity because the field is profoundly infinite and diverse. Everyone is a miracle. Everyone is unique. Every grain of sand, every snowflake. And yet it's connected in the unum, the pluribus unum. That's the logic of the union and unity in the I-thou space with the other. And that is a civilized space. And so what you're bringing out so beautifully, Gary, is that when you look at this in a medical practice, in our political behavior, educational parenting of our children, in practice of medicine, to the extent it's dominated by egomental and monocentric adolescent patterns and addictive forms of thinking in the box, we are mutilating ourselves. We're deforming our kids by pushing them into that form of education. So your question, beautifully, look at our leaders, our educators, our political leaders, our religious leaders. The question I would put to them in the spirit of your question, are our educators really seeing that a human being, a mensch, a person, is not an object? It's a presence. Are they seeing that nature is sacred? Are we educating, since the academy is the bastion of high literacy, if our literacy is dominated by egomental single bracket patterns where we talk about it and don't have the capacity to enter the space where Descartes broke through I-thou, the I-thou space and literacy, or Martin Buber, this I-it and I-thou. How many times do you need to hear this from the geniuses that they're two technologies? Martin Heidegger said they're two technologies, technological thinking and meditative thinking. And he said, we're blowing it, folks, because we're dominated by technological I-it thinking and not developing the literacy and capacity to surf the zone. And when we have our medicine there, it becomes the I-thou flow, the sacred flow, the love flow, the compassion, the vibration frequency you spoke of, energy that is harmonious. And that's the culture that Martin Luther King said, I've seen the other side, and I may not get there with you, but we're going to get there one day. He was visioning America in that double bracket space, where we heal the civic space of a multicultural, diverse society that could nevertheless find the motto on the back of the penny, E pluribus unum, out of the many, one. Not a single bracket one that separates, but a double bracket unum, unity, that holds us and celebrates our multiplicity and sacred individuality. When you see it in this light, we must ask, have we entered democracy yet? To remove the British in the Revolutionary War is stage one, but have we addressed the colonial lens that we're using in our hearts and minds in making our culture, where we have slaves and women can't vote, and we have this projection of hatred and burning people at the stake? All of that is coming from the colonized mind and the colonized human being. So it's very deep what you're asking and looking at and bringing out in this dialogue, Gary. Are we a free people? Can we flourish? Do we have the pursuit of happiness in an ego-mental culture? Or must we take the courage now for the ultimate unfinished activism on the planet to look at our script and our mental practices and to see the consequences medically and ontologically and to dare to have the courage to rise and listen to our great teachers? So that's the apathy you're speaking of. The apathy is a single bracket objectification where you're severed from yourself. How can you be an inspiring, energetic transfer leader or healer and confirm what you had the courage to show of the transfer of energy, at all levels? That is the nature of the field, the Om field, the Tao field, the Buddha field, the Christ field, and the field of science.
I thank you for those deep insights. I'd like for you to address several issues all interconnected to what we've been discussing, and that is that many people in this audience believe that we've reached an impasse where all we have believed to be true in the dominant ruling paradigm and hold such faith in, including science and medicine, psychology, needs to be reviewed in order to avoid the threats and crisis facing not just Western nations but the world at large. I'd like for you to discuss in depth this redefinition of our understanding and meaning of wisdom as separate from what you just discussed, since in the past it has always been related to philosophy, theology, and spirituality. And what appears certain today, as we watch our leaders in almost all walks of life bungle their way from one crisis to the next and only making matters worse, is that while we may call them bright and smart, the best and brightest, they certainly are not wise. Wisdom is simply absent in the decision-making necessary to address the challenges we face. So that's the first part of this. The second part is, when we look around, the world seems to be increasingly, as you said, egocentric, and as I would add, fragmented. There are scores of diverse worldviews and opinions, and they seem to be leading to what Samuel Huntington called a clash of civilizations. And many of these worldviews are very difficult for most people today to appreciate. The anthropocentric, climate change versus climate change denialism, or global free market capitalism versus all other economic beliefs. And rather than thinking we are evolving in consciousness, one would think we are in fact devolving. So what evidence is there for an evolution of consciousness, or what you call the awakening of the global mind? And also, why is communication and dialogue across conflicting worldviews and belief systems and paradigms so difficult, usually hostile rather than congenial? And I look at this, I believe we're witnessing a breakdown and a collapse for at least 70% of all the people in the United States. You don't see it. I'm out here filming Poverty Inc. I'm in my fourth year. I'll be finished with the filming. I'm filming people who have college educations. I'm filming people who have PhDs, who are on food stamps or working in car washes. I'm filming senior citizens who spent their whole life working in a dedicated way, honestly and diligently, for a company, only to have a company offshore their company and take away their pensions. And now these people are eating cat food instead of human food. None of this do we see. We don't see 17 million homeless or hungry children. We don't see 1.6 million homeless children after school each day. That's the largest amount in American history, including during the Great Depression. We don't see the 15 million direly poor senior citizens. We don't see people in their grief. We don't see how they cope and how few tools that they have from our system to cope. And as a result, when we look back at our generation, in the past, major fundamental changes have frequently been brought about by younger people, the 60s generation U.S. In the old Soviet Union, it was the younger generation of leaders who studied overseas in European universities that brought glasnost and perestroika. We saw regimes fall in the Arab world during the Arab Spring, not because of their academics, not because they're business leaders, but because of youthful, unemployed people who were educated, hungry, and didn't want to tolerate anymore. We didn't do anything in the United States. Our leaders continued to support every single tyrannical regime until it was obvious that they were going to lose. So as an educator of young adults, what values do you perceive in the younger generation that correspond with values that you would characterize as this new awakening in a culture that doesn't understand what happens when you alter the truth? Was it not it was Paul Tillich who said, "The passion for truth is silenced by answers which have the weight of undisputed authority." So we never look for the truth in those who have it. We look for those who pronounce, "We are the official truth and there are no other truths." So the AMA becomes the official truth of medicine. The networks, Fox or whichever, CNN, become the official truth for what should be presented to the public. And at every level, the official truth is what the younger people are receiving. It was Montaigne who said, "I speak the truth not so much as I would, but as much as I dare. And I dare a little more as I grow older." Please address these.
Well, you really lay it out beautifully, so just to look over the three areas that you invite to conversation, first one has to do, as I see, with the marketplace of our ideas and our culture making and the absence of wisdom, real wisdom, as we talked about it, as a place of an awakened consciousness and script and literacy of the I-Thou, of deep dialogue, of having skills of dialogue across borders, and a dilated lens with that, what I call lensitivity, when you become aware that lens that you have raised within your culture shapes your world and your world-making, and all of your perceptions and experience comes from your lens. And if you're not aware of that, you're uncritical, and you're sleeping on the job. And again, that comes with the territory of an ego-mental culture that's dominated by what I call the single-bracket mental processing. When you realize that the level of scripting and intelligence, that's which I call ego-mental or monocentric, where you see it from your mono lens rather than a dialogue, dialogos, where you can dilate a kaleidoscopic, flexible, open lens across borders. The fixed lens is what the geniuses saw, is the wall we're hitting, the evolutionary wall that creates the crisis we face. The evolutionary crisis is that our future is on the line. Our existence is in question. Our sustainability is deeply problematic. We're on a Titanic, and we've got to somehow see that and get off of that Titanic. And the Titanic is a mental processing that's dominant across the planet, and that's what our geniuses were diagnosing and seeing. It's going to take us down into deeper evolutionary dysfunction. And when you think about that, if that's what's dominating us and we have our different fragmented lenses of our cultures and we don't realize it, that's what generates the clash of worlds, as Huntington brought out, that after the Cold War, what's the next challenge of the 21st century? The clash of worlds. And 9/11 is one example of so-called Islam and the West, worldviews colliding. But that's old as the hills. The clash of worlds has been going on for millennia. But also the meeting of worlds. I mean, the trade routes and the meeting of Hellenistic and the Judaic language in John's Gospel leading to in the beginning is the Logos, and the Logos became flesh. That kind of talk is a creative meeting of alternative worlds. So when we have the I-Thou Christ lens and Buddha lens and yoga lens and Tao lens, so to speak, and have therefore the literacy to cross borders in a nonviolent way, why? Because wisdom takes us into the zone which is the source and ground and foundation of all possible worldviews and scripts and narratives. That's just very clear. And that's because they all saw the geniuses that in the primal field, it cannot be bound. It's unbound. It's unfinite. It's non-finite. It's infinite. Which means what? You can't step outside of it. Because if you did, you would finitize it. If Adam and Eve could really create themselves as atoms, A-T-O-M, and be a separately existing being, they would have demoted Yahweh to be finite. Can't do it. We're surrounded by the infinite field, and we can't step outside of it, thank God. And that's basic science. And if you break a piece of Om, you're going to get Om. What does that mean? Every unit is fractal. Now, what does that mean? It encodes the infinite in its own local way, boundless ad infinitum. And that's why Blake saw this infinity in a grain of sand, an eternity in an hour. The poets and geniuses and visionaries could see that when they tapped the zone of wisdom. So what you lay out beautifully is that what is the impasse? What is the barrier? Is there a barrier that after all of these centuries of Buddha and Socrates urging us out of the cave into the light of reason and Jesus dying on the cross to manifest the Logos in the flesh when he's saying, I am the truth, I am the way, embodying it. Because when you cross into the zone, you live the script, you become the script, because in the beginning is script. And we have lost the code to access that script, despite the geniuses teaching us and urging us and coaching us to rise and upscript rather than download. And so that's the impasse I see, the greatest impasse facing humanity across the planet. And the question that's almost to be scandalous, why have we not yet truly heard the geniuses in our scriptures that we worship and adore and respect? And we practice yoga, and we practice Zen Buddhist thinking, and we follow Christ, but are we really getting the medicine is the big question. What's blocking us? Could it be that the sin script and the samsara script, the objectified script, is so entrenched in our hearts and souls and passed on in our culture that we're hitting the walls and therefore cutting out the light and eclipsing the wisdom that would help us to find the deep dialogue patterns to connect our worlds? So the first question, part of your question, was about the impasse and the absence of wisdom, and why in the marketplace it seems to be stuck in opinions. And that's exactly what sophistry is. This is a very difficult thing I have to say now. That Socrates, when he questioned the wisdom teachers of his time and saw they didn't have the Logos, they got angry and put him to death. He saw it was sophistry. What is sophistry? It is taking your position, your subjective opinion to be truth, and believing that truth is opinion, and therefore the opinion that can be spin-doctored into being the dominant one will be seen as the truth. the official truth, as you speak about it, rather than genuine truth. You get genuine truth when you enter the zone, which is the field of reality, and in touch with it, and have a competence and skills of dialogue and the lens power to, and the script to handle the I-thou script. That's the space of truth. So the Quakers, the actual name for the Quakers is Society of the Friends of Truth. That's what founded Haverford College. And yet, if you look at our campuses, the question I have for years on campus, are we really living the wisdom? Are we really tapping the script? Are we holding the highest literacy of our founding heritage, or have we slipped back again into that opinion-dominated knowledge and artificial constructions in the box? And so your second part of your question about, given that our worldview is capitalism versus whatever, communism, or the ideological split in all sides of our society is endemic in the very script we're using to make our cultures. Mm. And that's the marketplace of democracy, and it's a broken civic space. And let so our democracy is in trouble.
Let me add one final question for us today, and that is, in a few days, there'll be a new movie, The Wolf of Wall Street. I filmed him and have his interview, and it's just amazing what he says about the greed of everyone in the culture down in Wall Street, not just those who got caught, but those who are considered legends. Now, both as a philosopher and historian in religion, do you perceive our myths of Western civilization as a barrier to our finding our place in the web of life that will force us to deal with current and future environmental and social catastrophes on the horizon more diligently? And, for example, the idea that humans are somehow at the top of the evolutionary ladder and therefore imbued with a sense of superiority, or the myth that technology and neoliberal free market economic theory will solve all of our answers. And then when we also take a look at how few people are going to the streets, how few people are protesting the inequalities, the injustices, the incursions upon all of our liberties and rights. Where are our philosophers? Where are our theologians? Where are our wise men and women? And we have them, but where are the masses? Tonight, many of them are watching a movie about how children kill children for the entertainment of adults. It's a very popular film. It's a part two of a sequel, and it'll probably gross $1 billion. It was Emile who said, "The man who has no inner life is the slave of his surroundings." So when you look around and you see our policymakers and our opinion leaders, from the Bill O'Reillys and the Sean Hannitys to the Barack Obamas and the George Bushes, these are people that we will remember less for what they did for the public and more for what monuments they built for themselves. And behind them are legions of young people who can't wait to start breaking ground on their edifices. Your thoughts, please.
Wow, wonderful question. I have so many things I'd like to share, Gary. And one of the things is a teacher at Haverford College in the Margaret Guest Center for Cross-Cultural Study of Religion, which is a sanctuary for dialogue of the kind we're speaking about across borders. I realized very early, 40 years ago, this is my 46th year teaching philosophy and helping students live the philosophy and live the wisdom, and I saw that the state of liberal arts, trained as a logician, which was looking at logic in the box, the objectified logic, monocentric ego-mental logic, that was where I was raised in my early mathematical logic and classical logic, and ontology, worldviews. And after I encountered some texts like the Bhagavad Gita, when I went to India for the first time in 1971 to look into what's going on there and taking a break, a sabbatical, and discovering Buddha's truth, as I studied Sanskrit and sitar and tabla, the drums, to just lose myself in the culture, I was astounded at what I found in terms of the meditative technologies. And I came back to Haverford in 72 and said to my colleagues, as a logician, I want to start teaching the Bhagavad Gita and Buddha's texts, and getting into Zen, I want to really go into the heart of Eastern wisdom to see what it can teach us, and the meditative forms of thinking rather than the predication, which I grew up in. Predication is predicating subjects and predicates in the box, and meditation is zoning and getting into the zone. And so that set my life in course for the last 40 years, and I saw right away I could not teach information in the box. I had to open and dilate the classroom for these young, brilliant students. Haverford is usually among the top 10 in the nation. We get very gifted students. I'm sure they're across the country, institutions. And I had the charge as a philosopher to help open the space of education, to help them dilate their lens and read these great texts and really feel the wisdom and breathe it in and get it in into their cells in that energy exchange in the modified, liberated liberal arts classroom. And over the years, I saw that I couldn't write books and speak in the single bracket space because wisdom sees that as problematic and we have to rise to the higher and dilate our hearts and minds. So what I see at the heart of your question is, where are the masses? Where are the people? Where are the leaders? Where is the vision? Who is seeing the greatest and deepest activism call on our planet now, the evolutionary crisis we face, is to somehow get to the people to understand that we're dominated and colonized by forms and patterns of thinking that our geniuses have seen through and diagnosed as at the source of our dysfunction, and that we have to upscript to a more powerful, competent ways of dialogue across borders, from monologue to dialogue. So the activism is, look at the person in the mirror. Am I living an ego-mental life? Am I monocentric? Do I have lensitivity? Do I understand dialogue? Am I living in and supplying and supporting the I-it culture or not? And if you see that you are, and you listen to the wisdom, it is our imperative duty, urgently, to occupy ourselves, to rise to our higher bodies, to occupy the common space, the commons, to step out into the civic space and say, enough, we must open up from monologue to dialogue. That is our destiny. We have time to be human, time to become a mensch, a human, a person, not an object. And so that, in very brief, is where we see that when you say a slave to our surroundings, that's going on in the dominant culture, it's stagnant. And we have hit the wall, and it's been for millennia. And so that is the crisis we face, Gary. And true activism is, look at that person in the mirror, and that's where we start. Am I ego-mental living? Then I must take responsibility. So the greatest Gandhi issue of the 21st century, the Mandela issue, overcoming apartheid, overcoming the colonial mind, am I living a colonial script? Am I trapped in the box? Am I living in the cave? Or am I awakening to global wisdom and enlightenment? This is the democratization of enlightenment for we the people. Every human is born for that space. That's who we are.
That's a great final statement in commission to this program. Thank you very much for being back on with us. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Gary, as ever. You be well.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And this concludes our Conversations with Remarkable Minds, a philosophical and psychological exploration into the origins of our society's dysfunction and the emergence of a new culture. Professor Ashok Gangadean, Gangadean. Have a nice day.